Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 46 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. Coming to you from beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the
rainy.
World. Rainy. Very rainy today. It's been a rainy spring and summer, I think.
I think we can say summer is springing.
Exactly. Convention season definitely springing.
That's right.
Got Origins coming up in a couple of weeks. And we're, as always, happy to bring you another episode of Game On, where we're going to talk about all kinds of great gaming stuff in the tabletop realm. And Cody, what are we talking about today? It's a little different. A little different app.
Yeah, we've got two By Triarder Knives for you. We've got a light game in Tichu, which is just a really light card trick-taking sort of game.
Oh, is it really that light? I don't know.
We'll talk about it. Yeah, and then we have a bit heavier fare, Dungeon Lords. We've been on how do you say his name?
The Vlada Shvatel,
yeah,
I think.
Him too. We've been on a Vlada Shvatel kick, and that was bad.
It's like in the Czech Republic, they're going, Quality Johns.
Yeah.
That was a terrible impersonation.
Is it Scottish?
I don't know. I don't know the Czech accent. Yeah. But
we're going to be bringing you a review of Dungeon Lords.
Yeah, but as always, we got the lots of gaming news and other stuff in the Game On inbox, and we'll kick it off
now.
The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it.
Well, it is the Game On Inbox, and before we get into games we've played and other gaming news, John's going to give you the skinny. Going to give you the scoop on Myriad Games.
It's on the QT, very hush-hush. All right, well, so Game On with Cody and John, as you know if you listen to the show, is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. You can check them out at myriadgames.com. And also want to mention specifically this episode, the Myriad Games Presentations podcast. Myriad Games is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network, like we are, and they have lots of great podcasts about different sorts of games. And their format is kind of a cool round table discussion. Like, they just put the recorder in the center of the table and they all talk. And so it really feels, when you listen to their, especially their session impressions where they sit and talk about different games, you sort of feel like you're just sitting and listening in on someone's game group.
Yep.
And a game group of cool people. And so I just checked out recently the Dominion Alchemy sessions impression. Where they were talking about that new expansion to Dominion. They also actually have, going back a bit, some great podcasts on Dominion and Dominion Intrigue. So and Seaside, I think they've done it for all of them. So if you're interested in Dominion specifically, I'd go and check out those specific.
There you
those
go.
Those Pacific podcasts. And
no, they're on the East Coast.
Yeah,
it's Atlantic podcast.
I got that Pac-10 thing with Texas on my mind. So anyway. So anyway, check out those podcasts from Myriad Games Presentations, and check out myriadgames.com. All right, so let's move on to games we've been playing. Cody, what you been playing?
A little mix of things old and new. I got the new Three Dragon Andy expansion.
Ooh.
And it's kind of odd because they released an expansion about 5 years after the main game came out.
A little late to the game,
I think.
A
little late, but it's nice because it brought that back to the table, and I really like it. I'm a big fan of the trick-taking games and in kind of, the pseudo, pub game sort of thing. And it's nice because the game's called Three Dragon Ante Emperor's Gambit. And it's pretty much a whole new set of cards. You could play it by itself, or you could combine it with the original.
Oh, so it is standalone.
It
you
is
just
standalone.
Buy that and play
yeah,
it,
you're
play
pretty much
that.
Doubling your cards with getting it. But it really plays well with the original set. You know, it's got the same backing and everything, so it's compatible there. It was a lot of fun. It was just they've done a few rules tweaks that they include in the rule book there, and we had a lot of fun with it.
Cool.
Played something else, a newer, well, it's a game that's new to me, not really a new game, and that's Modern Art, the Reiner Knizia joint.
Reiner Knizia auction game, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Played that one. I never played it, heard a lot of good things about it, and I enjoyed it.
How do you like the auction mechanic as a mechanic?
I like it. Yeah. It's one of those things where you have to have everyone in the group on the same page, you know, because you may have that guy in the group that, you know, like, oh, you went through the once, twice, sold too fast, or, you know, you might have that guy, and he shouldn't be in your group anyway. But I really liked it. It's kind of, you know, after playing For Sale, you know, that seems like the next step, you know, because there's a little more strategy involved in it, and you really feel more like you're wheeling and dealing, I guess. Oh, yeah. So
I forgot that the For Sale has that auction mechanic with the little money. That's cool.
Yeah. And one other thing, it seems like Monopoly Deal is getting the table more and more as a filler. Yeah. I like it all right, you know, it's like for $4 it's a fine game, but you know, it seems like everyone I've been gaming with more and more is just Monopoly Deal. I'm like, okay,
yeah, that's a good
we'll
good
roll
game.
With it. Yep.
Yeah. Better than Monopoly, I think.
That's true. Yeah.
And shorter. Cool. Well, I've been playing a few things, but the first thing I want to mention is that I have now finally, it's taken me quite a number of months now, but I finally assembled all of my Warhammer 40K figures from the Assault on Black Reach set. And like all the little helicopters and the dreadnought and all the space marines and everything. So I'm ready to play. Now, I don't think that I'm going to paint all of these guys before we get a game in. I think the goal was we wanted to get this starter set, and then Cody and I are going to play a game of 40K, and we'll cover that in a future episode of the show. So, finally ready to go. Unfortunately, after putting everything together, I'm missing two orc heads.
Oh, well.
And so my orc war boss has no head.
He can be an undead
orc war boss. Nice. So I don't know what happened there. I think it was probably because in the time that it took me to assemble them, I pulled the sprues out of the box a number of different times, and I think it must have just fallen on the floor. Maybe my cat ate it or something. I don't know. But so I'm looking forward to getting that to the table pretty soon. So stay tuned for that. Also been playing actually a lot of games that have been nominated for the Spiel des Jahres. We'll talk about the Spiel des Jahres in just a second, but I got a chance to play A la Carte with my kids. That was pretty cool. And we played a game of Dixit, which we'll talk about in a second. And I also got a chance to play Long Shot with my family. Now, that's one we talked about in a previous episode as being a great sort of gateway party horse racing game. And I played this one with my father-in-law and my four-year-old daughter. And now, you know, my four-year-old can't read, and so, you know, she wasn't able to really do much as far as the cards go, but she still had a great time, and we helped her move the horse, and she actually pulled a couple of cutthroat moves once I told her what a card did. Mm-hmm. Oh, Aaron, this card means that you can move any two horses back. She knew exactly which two to push back, the ones that belonged to, you know, Grandpa and Daddy. So that was a lot of fun. Long Shot, definitely a top pick there as far as party games go, so... and one other story I wanted to mention about gaming. It's not really a games that I've been playing, but I couldn't believe that this happened, and I just have to tell you. I went into my local game store, the Game Preserve.
Boo.
And it was fine. It was a good experience this time, except for what I'm about to say. as far as the employees and everything, they were all very nice. But I went in because they're doing a deal right now at the Game Preserve. And if you live in Indiana, we'll go into plug this a little bit, that if you're interested in War Machine and you like Privateer Press games, for the month of June, all of Privateer Press games that you buy at any Game Preserve, you will get triple points. Now, they have this points program at Game Preserve where for every... every dollar you spend, you get a point.
Right.
And then once you get 100 points, then you can redeem that for $10. So basically, a point's worth points worth 10 cents, right?
You're the math guy.
Okay. So as long as you have more than 100 points, then you can redeem those and get free stuff. So that's pretty cool. So I've been taking advantage of that and buying a few little War Machine things. And I got to the Game Preserve and I saw that they had a Fire of Salvation Heavy Warjack for Menoth. This is like a $52, something like that, model retail. And they had it marked down to $29. And nice. I looked at it, I'm like, man, that's pretty good.
Buy.
I wouldn't have even thought of getting that one, you know, so much, but with that price, plus I could have applied about $10-15 worth of points, you know, really great deal. So I'm like, man, that's awesome. Well, I'll look around a little bit and then I'll come back and get it. So there weren't that many people in the store. I walked over to where the board games were, and within less than 5 minutes, some dude walked in, grabbed that and like three other things, and was standing at the checkout counter. And then I walked back over there and saw that it was gone. And literally, I probably overreacted a little bit, but I literally looked over and said, "Are you kidding me? Are you buying that Fire of Salvation?" And the guy just looked at me and kind of gave me this smug look and went, "Yes." and what was I going to do? You know, I mean, he got it fair and square.
Take out the neck beard. Come on.
I got completely sniped. And one of the workers came over and he's like, you know, in all the time that I've worked here, I don't think I've ever seen that happen before. And I was like, are you serious? You're being sarcastic? He's like, no, I've never seen like someone get sniped at the store before. And I said, well, I could probably Indian leg wrestle him and take him. You know? He's like, oh, you could totally take him.
That's where you say, if you really feel sorry for me, then I'll take the other one you have.
They didn't have another one.
Well, though. You that's can order one. And
And then they give the good price. Yeah. I don't have these kind of skills. No. So I thought that was kind of funny. So, okay, congratulations to the guy who got the Fire of Salvation for
congrats,
the good price.
Well done.
He did not have a neck beard.
Oh, okay.
So that's about all that I've been playing. Want to move on to some emails?
I would love to.
Okay, let's do that. Cody, why don't you give us the first email in the inbox?
Alrighty. All right, our first email comes from Michael Katz. He's emailed before.
My Katz,
hey. He says, great reviews, like the double By Try or Deny segment. This is in regards to Through the Ages and Roll Through the Ages. He says, FYI, haven't had a chance to play this yet, but Roll Through the Ages has a free expansion called The Late Bronze Age, and it's on their website. You can go to rollthroughtheages.com. It's also available on the iPhone/iPod Touch as an app.
Now, thank you, Mike, for telling us that. Now, Cody, tell us a little bit about the... Would you know anything about the Roll Through the Ages?
Of course.
Have you ever been an owner of the Roll Through the Ages iPhone?
I have. I saw that advertised on Board Game Geek, and I bought it right then. Mm-hmm. It's a $4.99 app. And if you like Roll Through the Ages, it's a great way to do it. You can do solo play, or you can kind of pass your phone around. There's no AI or anything like that. So if you're playing by yourself, you're just kind of playing to beat your high score. But it is a really nice app. It's got the Late Bronze Age included, so you can just at the beginning of your game, you know, select that option if you want. I
have you played that yet?
Yeah, I found it leads to higher points. I don't know if it's just me, but it seems when I play with that, I score higher. I don't know if I just do better. But it's got things like achievements, and you can post things to Facebook if you're into that. I've been posting every time I beat my high score.
Yes, I blocked all those.
Yes, thank you. hey, it's not like, I've got a farm and I need helpers, you know.
Yeah, I blocked all of those. Yeah.
My mafia needs help. It's kind of funny. I was really proud of my achievement. I scored like a 58. That's my high score. Real proud of that.
Nice, yeah.
My like brother-in-law's first game, like a 64. Oh, and he's like, yeah, first game ever. Damn it, come on.
My average score is like 11 in that game, if I'm lucky.
Yeah. But highly recommended on that.
Cool.
And he mentions a few other games that have kind of worked on this.
Kind of an expansion.
Yeah, it's a little different. It's more like an errata expansion.
Okay.
Munchkin has a thing called Go Up a Level, where if you've got one of the older versions, you can just buy this pack and it updates your cards, so you don't have to go out and buy a whole new set.
Nice.
Not bad. And on the same front, another one that I've bought is Talisman. When Fantasy Flight Games picked up that license, they released a thing called the Upgrade Kit, which if you have the Black Industries version, that's the one I got, where they re-released it, and then the company, I think, like went under a year later. You know, I stood in line at Gen Con and bought it.
That was so hot that year.
I know.
Man, everyone was standing in line to get that game, and then it was gone.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
But so it basically... you know, exchanges all the cards and miniatures so that it'll be compatible with future Fantasy Flight Games expansions of it. And I thought that was a great deal. I'd like to see more companies do that, you know, and you know, they're trying to get more money out of you. So
that's fine.
But that is a nice kind of olive branch to the customers, you know, because I thought Fantasy Flight Games would be like, well, too bad you got the Black Industries version. You know, if you want to upgrade, you better get ours. But I should come to expect it from Fantasy Flight Games.
Well, it is nice, too, that if they see in a particular game that something slight could be changed, you know, to not go to all the rigmarole of, you know, let's wait till we put out that big box expansion. Just, you know, put out something small that people can buy for cheap. I mean, a good example, and this maybe isn't necessarily an expansion, but Cody and I just ordered the... a new stash card for Dominion through Board Game Geek.
With Tom Selleck on the front.
No. That's not that one. But it's a special promotional card. I mean, but it's not even really it's promotional, I guess, but it's really more of like just a little mini expansion where you just get this one extra card. So I think it's kind of fun to be able to add on things like that. It's a lot less expensive than having to get Descent plus all 15 expansions, you know?
Yeah.
Get a little bit of extra excitement in your game.
I know that Fantasy Flight Games, for their events they've been having at their event center, I know for the Realms of Terranoth event, they had promo card, you know, they had like a three heroes that you could use in Descent and use them in Runebound and Rune Wars. Yeah, I saved it there. And one more quick Fantasy Flight Games story. I'm almost done painting my Descent set.
Wow.
I've painted all my Talisman set. That wasn't that hard. I'm down to like nine heroes. Unfortunately, I had those cards out and somehow they got misplaced, or I think they got thrown away by mistake. So I didn't think Fantasy Flight Games would do this. I emailed him, told Thad my story.
Thad Pal,
girl after my own heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, how much do these cost? You know, I just need these nine heroes. And it was in the mail the next day.
Seriously?
Yep.
For free or did they? Really?
Just mailed it. Yep.
That's so amazing. Yeah.
So Fantasy Flight Games just gets better and better.
I just got to wonder what Thad's world is like. I mean, she must have like some giant warehouse with just, you know, little buckets full of parts and stuff.
I think I read an article. I don't know if Fantasy Flight Games put it out, but they basically, if I remember right, they have like a morgue where if they, you know, say I need those nine heroes and they don't have it in one of their already open sets of Descent, they'll open another set, take out those cards, and then just kind of leave it open to be picked through for other things.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, but
it's cool though. I mean, I had that happen when I bought StarCraft, the board game. I had two or three ships that were broken, just random ships. And I sent that an email and said, I need this one, a red, this one, and a blue, this one. And yeah, put them all in the mail there. So very cool.
Yep. I saw a thread on Board Game Geek saying Fantasy Flight Games had terrible customer service.
That's ridiculous.
Like, Thad Pal is a saint.
Yeah. They have fantastic customer service. Yeah. So anyway, another email here in the inbox from Taylor Grow, who actually was the one who traded with me so I could get that Assault on Black Reach set. Thanks, Taylor.
He's selling those orc heads for a premium right now, if you're interested.
He's holding them hostage. I never got those orc heads, did I? Okay. I got my eye on you there, Taylor. All right. He says, in your last episode, you both discussed ways to play Magic while avoiding the money sink. In my experience, the most enjoyable way to do this is to buy a box, open each pack, put them in sleeves, and number them. Each pack is one number. In other words, all 15 cards in pack one have a one on the lower right-hand corner. Then you can have a draft or a sealed deck or any other crazy event. Play with the cards and remake the packs by using the number in the lower corner of the penny sleeves. A friend and I have done this for a couple years now, and whenever we get together, we can do drafts or sealed decks for any of about five different blocks. You know, they pick their favorites. We can have evenings with new or experienced, do all sorts of different formats, and nobody has to buy a thing. The other thing I love about this is that you can remove all the cards that you hate to make the block better. For example, I have a box of 10th edition because it's great to play with my wife and kids and new players, but I hate the lucky charms, the uncommon artifacts that are useless. So I removed them all and put more useful artifact cards. You can also remove all of the rares that are useless or goofy and put in more useful or fun ones. For my buddy's Ravnica block, he has one of every single rare, except for the rare lands, which he sold off. It's a great way to have a play set of Magic, but to avoid all the cost. So
that's interesting.
So it's kind of like buying a reusable booster box.
Yeah.
Where, I never thought of the idea of reassembling the booster packs, you know, because you sleeve them and you've numbered them. It's like you can start over again.
Yeah.
And sort of redo it.
That's not
it.
A bad idea.
That's kind of a clever idea. So
it seems like the fates are conspiring to get me back into Magic, at least in some, you know. I'll never do the tournament scene, but it seems like it's we should host a draft or something.
Yeah, yeah. And I almost bought one of the sets of dual decks that they have. They've put out two or three of them now, where it's these two themed decks that are made to fight one another. So yeah. They had one of those at the local store that I thought I might want to pick up. So, and I did see, I mentioned in the last episode, the deck building kit that comes with some unopened boosters and then also some open cards to sort of help you in your deck building. It's only $20. I look pretty cool if you're a new player.
To sound like an old crotchety old man, it seems.
Get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn. It seems like deck building died a long time ago. Now it's deck copying. You know?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's like you go into a Friday Night Magic and you see three versions of one deck, you know.
Oh, nothing new under the sun.
That's right.
And one final email here in the inbox for this episode. This is from Nick Bate. He says, I just started listening to your convention tips podcast. I find these ones a bit difficult to connect with because I live in Australia. I'm not ever likely to make it to Gen Con or Origins, but low, he says, 34 minutes in, a way that I can participate. You mentioned the Puffing Billies, a group at Origins that play a lot of train games. And he said, I'd wager that they're called that because of Puffing Billy, a historical steam train that runs about 45 minutes away from where I live in the outer suburbs of Melbourne.
Huh.
And he lists the link here, and I can put in the show notes to puffingbilly.com.au. It has been around since the early 1900s, so it's pretty much as old as my nation. And it's exactly the sort of place you go to over and over when you're a primary school kid. And he says, or a grade school kid.
There you go.
Elementary school kid. Yeah. It winds through some pretty attractive bushland and hills, total train geek heaven. He said, and that, John and Cody, is likely to be the most I'll ever participate in Gen Con or Origins. So, Nick, thanks for that. And I actually did a little bit of mild research on Puffing Billies. And, that specific train in Australia is called the Puffing Billy. And I think that the reason why it's called that is that the Puffing Billy was actually a steam locomotive, like a type of steam locomotive that was designed in the early 1800s. And so it was actually in service for quite a number of years, and especially in the UK. So I can see how that sort of might have translated down to Australia. And so
train on.
What can I say? So anyway, thanks for that. And hey, you know, you never know, Nick. You know, keep the faith. You might end up at Gen Con someday, and if you do,
beautiful Indianapolis,
come and hang out with us. So that's what I got as far as emails in the inbox. Let's move on to just a little bit of news. The main news and the big news for in gaming in the last couple of weeks has been the announcement of the nominees of the Spiel des Jahres, the German Game of the Year.
Yep.
Now, in years past, we've given the Spiel des Jahres a little bit of a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, I even listened back to an old episode where we said, and the nominees were announced, and we don't care. But, you know, I feel like I've softened a little bit on this. And, you know, the games that have been nominated, I think it's probably because of my kids getting older. So I'm interested in playing games that are more family-oriented now.
Mm.
And so that's really the target demographic here, is to create those sort of family games. So here are the five nominees for the Spiel des Jahres. And the award will be announced, the final award will be announced on June the 28th. A la carte. Identique, or also the American version is called Portrayal.
Identique.
Fresco. Dixit. Or as the Scottish would say, Dexit. And Roll Through the Ages.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So you've played a couple of those, right? Uh-huh. Now. And I mean, give me your impression of the Spiel des Jahres, and you know, how do you feel about it? What are your feelings about it, the award?
To me, I'm kind of, you know, I see what has won before, you know, Settlers and Dominion mm-hmm. and, you know, games like that. So I'm generally pretty good on it. You know, what won it last year?
Dominion.
Oh, that was last year? Okay. Because yeah. I remember we played games like Finca, and that was a nominee. And
yeah, that was got beat by Dominion. Yeah. You know?
I don't know. I'm interested with this field. I've played three of them. I've played Dixit, I've played Portrayal, and I've played Roll Through the Ages. Mm-hmm. Not having played the other two, I think Dixit is going to win.
Really?
Yeah. It seems like it. The Spiel des Jahres is more an innovative mechanic sort of a thing instead of a good game.
I mean, see what you're saying there.
I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive, because Dominion has an innovative mechanic and is a good game. It just seems to, you know, reward the new hotness, which is fine.
Well, yeah, because it's that game that you sit down to and go, this is clever, yeah. You know, and let's play this again. Niagara is a great example of a game that's not really a great game.
Not at all.
But it... okay.
Sorry. Yeah, I hate
Niagara. Feel stronger about Niagara than I thought. but you can't deny that the mechanic of having and the board design and having the little movement of the water with the discs, that's pretty innovative. And I'm sure that, you know, kids like it. My kids like to play that game because it's, you know, it's fun to... Oh, daddy's canoe's going over the edge.
it's like the Spiel des Jahres, the seal won't make me instantly buy a game or not buy a game.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, it'll make me try out a game. It's like, well, that one won that, and a lot of good games have won it in the past, so I'll try it. But Dixit is my pick.
Okay, well, it's a good mix because you've got Roll Through the Ages, which is like, people have called it Yahtzee on steroids. It's like this, you know, dice rolling resource game.
Is it that good? Is it Spiel des Jahres good?
I don't know. You got Portrayal, which is a drawing game, which that's kind of surprising, but it's kind of a twist on a drawing game where it's more about describing the picture and very specifically, and then, you know, asking questions based upon what's been drawn.
Yeah, that has no chance.
But again, it fits in that sort of innovative mechanic. Oh, that's a twist on the normal way of doing, you know, games like that. A la carte, which I really think the a la carte only got nominated because the components on that game are just crazy. You know, you get you're cooking, it's a cooking game, mm-hmm. and you actually get pans, like comes with metal frying pans and this little three-dimensional cardboard stove that you set it on top of. And so, I mean, the kids love that kind of a game, but the actual mechanics of it are not super great. And then you've got Dixit, which I agree. I think that would be my pick too, because it's innovative in the way that presents sort of this apples to apples-y sort of mechanic. So not to get too far into it, but just for those of you who have never heard of Dixit before, it's basically a game where you have these cards that have these pictures on them, and it's this really intricate artwork, and they're really wacky pictures too. And the idea is that you're going to look at your cards each round, and you're going to say a phrase or a word or a sentence. It can be anything, you know, but you want to be sort of specific, but not too specific. So, you know, you might say something like, I just drew a complete blank, you know,
a difficult decision.
Right. You know, and then you'll put your card down face down. Everybody will then look at their cards and pick a card of theirs where the picture would match a difficult decision. Gather up all the cards face down, and then you're going to lay them all out. And then the three people who aren't the like storyteller who picked the first card are going to try to guess who the storyteller's card is. And so you want to kind of try to fool the other players by playing cards that, you know, really seem to fit that particular sentence or phrase. Because the idea being that if the storyteller, the person who laid down that first card and said the phrase, if everybody picks their card, or if nobody picks their card, then they don't get any points. Otherwise, they'll get 3 points, and anybody who picked their card will also get 3 points. So it's like you want it to be a good enough phrase that some people will get your card, but you don't want it to be so good that everybody gets it. So I think that's a really kind of a cool scoring mechanic. And then anybody who picked your card that you laid down, you know, that you'll get a point for that too. So there's like a board that goes around. It's like bunny rabbits on a trail.
Yeah, I don't get that.
I have no idea where that came from.
But it's in the Dixit novel.
Yeah. I don't know. But I think that's that style of game where it takes that sort of voting mechanic of apples to apples, but it really turns it on its head a little bit. It's very accessible.
It's like a very highbrow apples to apples.
It is. We were saying it's like apples to apples for college graduates or for people with master's.
NPR listeners.
For NPR listeners.
We are playing Dixit.
We kept making fun of Cody's wife because she has a master's degree and she was in last place for most of the game. Sorry, Kaylin.
Yeah.
But I think that's of the five that are there. Now, Fresco just seems to be a real sort of basic run-of-the-mill, I guess, worker placement game. It's the most Euro-ish of all the games. And, you know, we'll see how it goes. You know, that's kind of what Finca was last year. It was kind of the most Euro-ish of all of them.
Fruit. Hey.
Woo.
That's cool.
All right, so that's enough about the Spiel des Jahres. If you want to check out a award that is for games that are really more our speed, that we're really more keyed into.
Our speed.
Speed probably wasn't the right word.
Candyland.
check out the Dice Tower Gaming Awards. You can go to thedicetower.com, and there should be a link there. We're on the committee, actually, to pick the nominees for this, and the nominees for the Dice Tower Gaming Awards have been... it's in many, many different categories, but those have been released, and we're going to be voting on those in July, and you'll be able to find out what the winners are. But it's games that are really more up our alley.
Agreed.
All right, one last real quick piece of news, and that is from a game company called Petroglyph Games, and they are the company that put out a game called Panzer General Allied Assault, which was an Xbox Live Arcade game that has been also turned into a board/card game. That's kind of an interesting idea that they took the video game first and then made it into a card and board game. And this seems to be the trend that they're going with. They're going to be coming out with another version of Panzer General called Russian Assault that's going to be Xbox Live Arcade and a board game. And then they have this other game. It's more like a fantasy adventure game called Guardians of Graxia. Again, it's going to be released as a video game and as a board game. beyond that, they're even doing a version of this Graxia world called Heroes of Graxia, which is a deck building game, kind of Dominion like, that is in this world. So I just think it's real interesting. There may be a company to watch here, because, you know, to have a company that has this integrated video game and tabletop game plan, you know, sort of business plan worked out, I think is different.
Yeah, I just wonder if they're any good.
I don't know. I haven't played any
games. I haven't either.
Yeah, I haven't played any of these games.
If any of you listeners have, give us the skinny.
Yeah, check it out. So, and we may try to pick up one of these games. Actually, I think that these guys would be kind of fun to have on the show. Mm-hmm. I think they would have a real interesting perspective. So,
it's funny
to make that happen.
That reminds me of you've got the Prince of Persia movie came out, right? Based on a game, So there was the game, then they made the movie. They made a game based on the movie, like to tie in with it.
They made a game based on the movie based on the game.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
What? That doesn't make any sense.
That's like making a video game that's based upon the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Yeah.
That would not be a good thing.
R.I.P. Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. So
he was King Koopa.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I didn't even know
that. Movie scared the crap out of me, because I was a kid. I was right in the Nintendo age when that came out, and it was this like dark, kind of violent...
it was weird.
I was a very confused little boy sitting in the theater.
Well, my son is now discovering Mario, Super Mario, for the first time. We rented some of the cartoon Super Mario Brothers.
Oh yeah,
which had like Lou Albano at the end. Swing your arms from side to side to the Mario. And the cartoons are really creepy too, because it's like they're in this bizarro video game world, but it's these Italian plot. Give me the creeps, really.
Mario on.
Yeah, okay. So if we talk about anything for too long, Cody kind of starts steering me in another direction. That is it for news. The only last thing I want to mention for the Game On Inbox is once again that I will be at Origins. The weekend of the 20-somethingth of whatever weekend Origins is, I will be there.
John is a podcaster.
Yeah, I am. Very well rehearsed. Thursday through Saturday is when I'll be there. Be sure to check out, if you want to, in the boardroom, the Wits and Wagers game show that's going to be run by Eric Summer from the Dice Tower, and I will also be co-hosting that. That's going to be Thursday night at 7 in the boardroom. And then I'm planning on trying to run a Descent game, because I had a couple of people express an interest in learning Descent, so I'm going to bring my copy of that and just run sort of a basic dungeon of that, probably on Friday night. So if you want to email me at the Game On Inbox...
at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Yep. Or you can... there's a thread on our Board Game Geek Guild that's sort of talking about that. If you just want to get in touch with me ahead of time, I can put your name on the list there, and we'll see if we can get a game together of Descent.
He's a complete pushover as a overlord. It will be an easy victory for all involved.
It will not. I will kill you multiple times. Uh-huh. It will be very sad.
How did that custom dungeon work out?
That was different.
Oh, yeah.
We're not even going to talk about that.
Okay.
All right, that's all I got for the Game On Inbox. How about you?
That's all I got.
All right, well, let's move on to our double review here with Teachu and Dungeon Lords. Well, I would say that it's the big deal, but it's not. We're just kind of doing two reviews here and a little bit of a discussion. We're going to talk for a second about, I guess, trick-taking card games and just sort of family card games that are sort of, Cody, why don't you tell us what we're talking about?
Sure. When we played Teachu, it reminded me a lot of, I don't know if it's just a regional thing. I would say it's at least nationwide, and it's probably worldwide, mm-hmm. Families and areas seem to have card games that are meant for them. Here in Indiana and a little bit of the surrounding area, Euchre is a really popular game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a partner-based card game, trick-taking, things like that. I know Uno is actually pretty popular as well, partner-based. When I was growing up, my parents would play, like, have a weekly Uno game, and mm-hmm. they'd play that in Euchre, and I know in other areas of the country, Hearts is very interesting, and you have...
In my childhood, I grew up in Virginia, but my grandparents on my dad's side were all from New England and from, like, Canada up in that area, and they played a whole lot of Rummy. I don't know if you... It's not like Michigan Rummy, but we just called it Rummy. I think it was like Rummy 500 or something like that.
Yeah.
If I sat down and taught someone how to play it, someone would probably say, oh, that's blah, blah, blah. But we didn't have a name for it other than Rummy. But it was a card game that we always played.
Well, my in-laws have a family game that's at least a few generations old, called, they call it Hawaiian rummy, but it may have the same mechanics as, you know, some other rummy somewhere else. But
yeah, yeah.
But for some reason, they don't even know why it's called that, but it's called that.
Someone was drinking Hawaiian punch while
maybe, I don't know. But it's just interesting because I'm as we'll talk about with Tichu, I think you'll find that a lot of the mannerisms of play, and this goes with any card game, is just a little different from group to group. And this is more so than a standard border card game, because with you know, these kind of trick-taking, these partner-based games, the amount of table talk that is allowed is much different. You know, in bridge, you know, you might have conventions, you know, where you say, oh, if I pass you a low card, that means, you know, this. Or, mm-hmm. And there's a certain amount of talk allowed. You know, we played a game where if we played with other Tichu players, they may think that was just like, oh, you can't say that. You know, you're not supposed to say that. I just think it's interesting that one game can be played 20 different ways depending on where you're playing it and who you're playing it with. And it seems to be that specific to those kind of card games.
And it's, and not even get into too much psychology, but it's almost like a social contract. It's like in a particular setting like that, a certain amount of table talk would be allowed, but in another setting it wouldn't be allowed. And it's a sort of socially acceptable, and what's socially acceptable or not. I think that these card games, they definitely are good for people who are competitive, mm-hmm. I think. But I think it also, there's also a danger of, you know, it's kind of hurting people's feelings. Because, yeah. You know, I think you do, when you're playing partners, it's like, you know, two versus two is sort of different than one versus the rest of the people that you're playing with. Because, you know, there's sort of that camaraderie, you know. Yeah. It's me and this other person against you, you know. And you, I think it just generates a lot more talk like that.
I know even locally there's some euchre players who... I don't know how to describe them besides cheers. There's like these little things. It's like once they get to 7 points, they do a little hand thing with their partner. And if they're, once they get to 8 points, you know, they're milking the cow or something. You know, there's these weird, it's this thing where you put both your thumbs down. And I'm showing it for a video podcast.
Yes, that was great.
and people like pull the thumbs like they're milking. I don't get it. You know, it's like, how the barn doors open, bring in the, you know, it's these weird colloquial things that make no sense outside of the game.
Yeah.
But this strikes me as something that could be one of those, like, you know, it could teach you could be one of the family games, as it were.
Yeah.
So I would actually like to, that's not much of a big deal discussion per se, but I'd really like to get listeners' input on this. What card game is popular amongst the unwashed masses, as it were? You know, it's like, yeah, they may not be playing Tichu, but there may be a lot of Euchre or Hearts or Spades.
Pinochle or Canasta.
Auction Bridge, kind of, you know, whatever. Yeah. Uh-huh. Shoot us an email at the Game On inbox or give us a call.
At the Game On voicemail box, it's 4138 Game On.
There it is. And tell us what's popular in your area. I'm more curious than anything.
Yeah, and I've just found that most families I talk to have something like that in their something that was played with their regular deck of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Now don't limit yourself. If you've got some other game that you played with some different deck of cards, that's fine. But you know, Tichu, for example, is a card game that is almost a regular deck of cards with just a couple of exceptions.
Yeah.
So do you want to go ahead and do we want to launch into our review?
Let's do it.
Okay.
That was just a little sociological sidebar for you. Listen, I'm going to teach you how to make it funky. Funky. I'm going to teach you how to say ooh yeah. Ooh yeah. I'm going to teach you how to make it funky.
Well, this was kind of a surprise, though. You know, when we were kind of putting together what this show was going to be about, I don't think we were initially planning on it being about Tichu, but mm-hmm. I had picked up this game just at the local game store because I'd heard good things about it and played it, and we were really impressed with it. We'll just go ahead and put the cards on the table, as it were, and just say that we really enjoyed it, so we thought it was worth talking about. So Tichu is a game for... The box says 3 to 10 players, but don't be fooled. This game is for four players. It is for two sets of partners, and whatever variants they have in the rules, I mean, maybe they're okay. We're not going to cover those at all, though. We're just going to talk about the four-player game. It was designed in 1991, and who was the
You mean designer? In ancient China.
Well, that's kind of the weird part about this game, and I'm kind of looking at the box right now, is that it was designed in 1991, and I believe that the designer was German, but they really, in the rules, make it look like this is an ancient Chinese game that's played by 900 million Chinese every day.
Yeah.
But anyway, so... But I believe it was designed in 1991. It's for, like I said, four players. The box says ages 10 and up. that's probably about right. Maybe the intricacies of the strategy might require a slightly older 12 player, up. Maybe 12 and up. Yeah. But the basics of the rules are pretty easy. And, this game consists of a deck of cards and it is a standard deck of playing cards. And then there's four, kind of special cards that are added onto it and that's it. So it's just a deck of 56 cards. And so it's packaged with sort of a Chinese theme to it. So your normal suits aren't there. Instead, you've got like jade and swords and pagodas and stars mm-hmm. instead of your, you know, clubs, spades and diamonds.
Hearts and diamonds.
Hearts and diamonds, yeah. and the version that I have, which is from Rio Grande Games, actually comes with two decks of cards. So I think the idea being that you play with one. Well, either you play with one and you have one that's already shuffled up so you can go faster, mm-hmm. or you play with one until it wears out and then you can use the second one. So it worked out good for Cody and I because we bought one set and Cody gets one deck and I get one deck. So.
That's the method I prefer.
Yeah.
Cody gets a free game.
Cody gets a free game. He enjoys that one. So in this game, it's a trick-taking game and a partnership game. The goal of the game is to win. The way that you win for you and your partner is to get 1,000 points. Whoever gets to 1,000 points wins. And that's going to be done by winning rounds, winning tricks, and winning these mysterious things called teach-yous. And if you don't know how to play this game, I will teach you.
Oh.
Did you get it? Okay. So what you're going to do in this game is to start out is you're going to be dealing out all the cards. The game says that that the Chinese don't deal cards, that they draw cards, and that you're supposed to put the deck in the middle.
We tried that last night.
Did you?
Played a game with some of our friends. No, just deal it.
Just deal
it. It takes forever.
Yeah. So you're going to deal out the cards. Everybody will get 14 cards, so you're going to deal the entire deck out. And in this game, you're going to be trying to claim tricks. And the way that you do that, it's sort of a ladder-style mechanic, where on your turn, you're going to get to play any of a number of different kinds of cards. So you could play a single card. You could play a pair of cards. You could play a sequence of pairs, like two twos and two threes. Or, you know, multiple pairs, two twos, two threes, and two fours. You could play a three of a kind. You can play a full house, which is, you know, a trio and a pair. Or you can play a straight, a sequence of at least five cards. So four, five, six, seven, eight, something like that.
Nine. No, that's five cards.
That's, yeah, so that's six.
Sorry.
Square, yeah, at least five cards. And then the player to your left would then have to play a combination that's at least higher than that. So if you played three threes, then that would have, you know, that could only be beat by three fours or higher. And the rule is that if a single card is led, then a single card has to be played. So if a full house is led, then a different full house has to be played. You can't play like a single card on top of a full house. And so it's going to go around and you're going to either play a higher one, a higher combination, or you're just going to say pass. And if there's three passes, then the person who was the last one to play gets the trick. They claim all the cards and they put them in their pile. And then they will lead out the next one. And you're going to basically keep going around and doing this until all three of the players are out of cards. Once three players are out of cards, then the player who's like the last person to have cards is going to take the cards that are in their hand and they're going to give them to their opponent. And then all the cards that they have claimed as tricks are going to go to whoever went out first. So, which could be your opponent or it could be your, your
partner.
Teammate. Yeah. It doesn't, could be
your buddy,
your
friend,
buddy, that guy or gal. And so that sounds very similar probably to you to a lot of other trick-taking games that are out there. The wrinkle comes in when we start talking about the four special cards. And so one of the special cards is called the one or the mahjong or the sparrow or the guys from the spiel, they called it the hemp chicken, which I thought that was funny. So we used that a couple of times. If you get that card in your hand, then you will be the one who leads. So whoever has the one or the mahjong will lead. If you decide to play that card, you don't have to lead with the mahjong, but if you decide to lead with it as a single card, then you can do what's called making a wish. So you lay that card down, and then you say what card you wish for. I wish a seven. And then that means that starting with the player to your left, if they have a seven in their hand, they have to play a seven. And it'll just, if they can't play a seven, then they'll play whatever legal card would something higher than a one. And then it would go around and, you know, it basically has to be, that wish has to be fulfilled if it can be. And so usually most of the games we play, the wish is usually fulfilled by the first or the second mm-hmm. person will have the cards you're looking for. So that's a good way to sort of get certain cards out of people's hands. And when we get to scoring in a minute, you'll start to see where that can be really strategic. So that's the Mahjong. And you can also use the Mahjong as part of a straight, like you can make it a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. The next special card is the Dog, which can only be played if you're leading. And when you lead out the dog, it's not worth any points. The only thing that it does is it transfers the lead to your partner who's sitting across from you.
It's really annoying to get stuck with the dog as your last card.
Yeah, because there's pretty much no way that you're going to get the lead back.
That's happened twice already in two games.
Oh, that's
I need to learn.
Yeah. So you want to try to get that one out. You don't want to get stuck with it at the end. But that'll just transfer the lead to your partner. And so that can be a good strategic thing if your partner has some good cards they want to play and you've maybe used up all the good tricks that you can claim. So that's the Dog. Then you have the Phoenix. Now, the Phoenix is a wild card. It can be used as in any combination, in a three of a kind or four of a kind or a straight or whatever. It can be used as any value. If it's used as a single card, then its value will be half a point higher than the previous card that was played. So if someone played an 8 and then you played a Phoenix, then the value of that card would be 8.5. So that could be then, of course, beat by a 9. But if someone played like a King, then that would be a King and a half. If someone plays an Ace, which is the one of the highest cards, that would be an Ace and a half. And at that point, the only thing that could beat the Ace and a half would be the Dragon.
Nice lead in. That was good.
But before we talk about the Dragon, let me go back to the Phoenix here. If you use the Phoenix and then you win a trick with the Phoenix in it, unfortunately, the Phoenix is worth minus 25 points.
Ouch.
And so that's kind of weird that you would want to use it because it's high and you want to win the trick with it, but you're going to get minus points for it. The Dragon is the highest card in the game. It can only be played as a single card, and if you so you're basically going to guarantee that you'll win a trick with that, more or less. And if you win a trick with the Dragon, then all of the cards that you had in that trick will go to your opponent. And the Dragon's worth 25 points. So you're basically giving 25 points to your opponent. But you do get to keep the lead. And keeping the lead in this game is a really important thing. So that's the Dragon. So that we have the Dragon, the Phoenix, the Dog, and the Mahjong. Okay. So the other thing that you want to keep in mind in this game is something called bombs. And that's probably the only thing that's going to be able to top the Dragon. A bomb is a combination of either four of a kind or a straight flush of at least five cards. And so that's all of the same suit. These are kind of rare combinations to get in your hand, and you can't use the Phoenix as part of a bomb.
It's got natural bombs
only. Gotta be natural bombs only, yeah.
Green bombs.
But the bomb is basically, you can play this at any time. You can even play it when it's not your turn. And you can just toss those cards in there and say, I'm bombing this trick. And then the only way that that could be topped would be by a higher bomb. So if someone played four fours and say, I'm bombing this trick, even if it was the Dragon, I'm bombing it with four fours, then the only thing that would be higher than that is if someone played a higher four of a kind, or if they played a straight flush. The straight flush beats the four of a kind, too. Okay. So
I was just about to ask that.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
But it's so rare that it happens anyway that you're not usually going to see multiple. I think we saw multiple bombs like one time in our game.
Yeah.
So, and so then you would claim all those and you would get the lead. So that's sort of the push and pull of how the game works. Now, the scoring is very interesting because of all these cards that you're playing and throwing out and all these combinations, there's only just a few cards that actually have any point values to them. Kings and tens are each worth 10 points. And then your fives are worth 5 points. That's it.
Yeah.
Then you have the Phoenix, which is worth minus 25, and the Dragon, which is worth 25 points. And that is all the points in the game.
This is where I got the Euchre vibe from it, because the rules are altogether not very intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
They seem just kind of slapped together. But when you play it, it's just a different story.
Yeah.
So just a word of warning. You may be listening to this and being like, this doesn't make any sense. This seems just really disjointed. It's worth a play because everything kind of gels after two or three hands.
And I'll admit that when I taught this to Cody and Kaylin and our friend Morgan the first time, even as I was saying the rules, I'm like, I don't know why it's like this. I'm just saying what the rule book says. And then when we started playing it, it's like, oh, now I sort of get it. Like, especially the thing with like the Phoenix and the Dragon, where you know I'm playing the Phoenix and I'm winning a trick with it, but I'm getting minus 25 points. Well, that's no good. No. But you see that keeping the lead a lot of times is more important than losing those 25 points. And then if you happen to have been playing the Phoenix on a trick that already had 30 points in it anyway, you still come out in the positive.
Right.
So little weird strategic things there. Now, the other thing, the game, it would be pretty cool just as I described it to you, except that there are also the things called the Tichu and the Grand Tichu.
Le Grand Tichu.
Now, the way the Tichu works is it's basically making a claim that you are going to go out first. And you can do this when you get your cards anytime up until the first card is played. You can say, I'm calling a Tichu. And then you're going to see if you can do it. If you do go out first and you get the Tichu, then you're going to get 100 points for your team, in addition to any other scoring that's going to be going on in that round. If you don't get the Tichu, though, you're going to lose 100 points. Mm-hmm. So topping that is then the Grand Tichu.
Le Grand Tichu.
Le Tichu Grand. And the Grand Tichu is where you're going to do the same thing. You're going to claim that you're going to go out first. But you have to do this after looking at only the first 8 cards of your hand. So the way we did it was we basically dealt out 8 cards to everybody first. And you looked at those first, and then you just said, you know, do you want to call a Grand Tichu? And if not, then we would deal out the other 6 cards and then see if there were any Tichus that wanted to be called. But you only get 8 out of your 6, your 8 out of your 14 cards to look at, and then you have to decide whether you want to go for the Tichu, which would be the Grand Tichu. If you're able to pull off a Grand Tichu, which Cody did in magnificent fashion in one of our games, and then you're going to get 200 points. Again, if you don't get the Grand Tichu, then you're going to lose 200 points. And keep in mind that this is all individual stuff, too. So if Cody and I are playing as partners and I call a Grand Tichu and Cody goes out first, then we don't get the Grand Tichu. We lose 200 points. It has to be that individual person. But you know what? That actually reminds me that I forgot to mention one rule of the game that is kind of important when it comes to the Tichus. And that's that after you get all 14 of your cards in your hand, after you've drawn all your cards, you're going to be passing 3 cards to your opponents and to your partner. So you're going to pass 1 card to your partner and 1 card to each of your opponents face down. Every player is going to do this. So this is a chance to kind of swap out some cards, maybe get rid of some bad cards into your opponent's hands, you know, give your partner some good cards. So if you call a Tichu and your partner knows that, maybe they'll pass you a card that'll make your hand even better. So that can be some strategy there too. So the only other thing in the game that can help you to get points is what they call the double victory.
Big fan of the double victory.
Well, double victory,
you used it many times last night.
And that's when both you and your partner are the first and the second people to go out and to get rid of all your cards. And if you do that, then the round basically stops. And your team gets 200 points, and the other team gets nothing.
Nope.
You get nothing.
Yeah, the only other thing you factor in are Tichus or anti-Tichus.
Do you factor in the Tichus?
Yeah, we actually checked that last night.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Because it came up, and we're like, well, does that count? And apparently the only thing that when you do a double victory, you just don't score points on cards.
Oh, okay.
So any fulfilled or unfulfilled Tichus or La Tichu Grands still count.
Oh, this is all good news to me. And for being simple, relatively simple with rules, you'll find that like on Board Game Geek, there are pages and pages and pages of rules questions because of these sort of intricacies. Okay, so you can actually get a Grand Tichu and a double victory in the same.
From what I've seen, yes.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. So that's the double victory, and so that's all the ways that you can score. And you're playing to 1,000 points, so you can see that if there's only 100 points in the cards per round, that the majority of these points are really going to be gotten when people are calling Tichu and Grand Tichu and getting the double victories. And we found that the points can swing pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Cody and Morgan were playing. They were up like 575 to 150 for Kalen and I, and we actually were able to come back and win it.
Yeah.
And after Cody said, well, we're just going to sit here and run out the clock,
I'm
like, ha, ha, ha. So anyway, but that's one of the things that I think that makes the game kind of fun is because, you know, you're never out of it. You know, you can always call that Grand Tichu, and based upon the cards that you get, you could pull it out there. So, as we mentioned before, our review format for Buy, Try, or Deny is that instead of giving you just a simple rating for the game, we're going to give you what we call our buy points, things we love about the game, try points, things that are kind of in the middle, and then deny points, things that we just think don't work at all. And from that, hopefully you can get an idea whether this is a game for you. So, Cody.
Hi.
Give me your buy points for Tichu.
Like I said, as one who really likes trick-taking games and just kind of family social games, you know, with cards, I think this is on par with Euchre, Spades, Hearts, whatever you want to say. It's a lot of fun. There's a surprising amount of tension when you're playing. You know, you feel like high stakes teach you.
Yeah.
But it's one of those games where once everyone knows it, I think the well really gets deeper for strategy and other sorts of planning. And I think you can even get to the point where you can just talk casually while you're playing. Mm-hmm. You know, you just get in that mode. So I think it's interesting to see a quote-unquote gamer game fill the niche of a lot of these family and regional card games. So that's a big buy point for me.
Cool. All right, well, for me... the production quality on the cards is just amazing. No, it's deck cards. I think that I've played lots of Spades and Hearts in the past, and I just think that this game blows all of those out of the water. I think that I just like them a lot better than any of those trick-taking games. I think it's probably the favorite trick-taking game that I've ever played because it has that great mix of simple but deep at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you can play it on a simple level, and you can just kind of throw cards out. And sometimes maybe it'll work out for you, you know. But that if you want to play this real deeply and strategic, you really can. And those cards that are kind of counterintuitive, the Phoenix, the Dragon, you know, that learning how to play those is a lot of fun. And I think it's a game that rewards multiple plays. And I think that's a positive thing too, because I think this could turn into something like, hey, we're having T2 night, you mm-hmm. know. You could get a couple of decks of this and get eight people together and, you know, partners, and you could trade off games and all that kind of stuff. You can make a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
Terrific fun. So that was my conglomeration of buy points there. What about try points?
As I said earlier, the rules and learning the game can be pretty finicky because the rules, like I said, it seems like they're cobbled together and that they're very unintuitive. Playing it's a different matter. So I would say if at all possible, get someone who already knows how to play to teach you. I didn't even plan that.
Well done.
Not to bag on John. He did a fine job.
No, that's fine. I completely agree with you.
This just seems like one of those games where if you teach it by the rule book, you know, even if you have a really good teacher like John, it's still going to be... It just doesn't make any sense until you play it. But if you get someone who's played quite a bit of teach you, I think it goes a lot faster. So just a word of warning there.
Yep. I think that probably the only thing I could think of is if you're someone who just doesn't like this kind of game. I mean, you know, if you don't like trick-taking games at all, then you know, try it anyway, because it, you know, you might find that it'll change your mind about trick-taking games. But I think that overall, this probably wouldn't be the kind of game for you.
Yeah.
You know, of course, just the fact that you're limited by number of players, I think, is a try point that this game really is really a four-player game. Like I said, I didn't even really look at the rules for the other other numbers, because I just can't see how that would work out.
I can bet they're pretty forced. Yeah. Not very good.
So, you know, you got to find a way to get four people together. But if you, you know, maybe you're a couple and you have another couple over for dinner or something, this would be a fun one to pull out after dinner, I think. But that would be a limiting factor, I think, and a try point. How about deny points? Any deny points for Tichu?
The only deny point is I honestly thought this was an ancient Chinese game or something. And then when I found out
ancient Chinese secret?
Yeah, I found out it's all a sham. So I kind of don't like the way it tries to push that. You know, it's like, oh, you know, in traditional Chinese way, you know, we'll go to the right, or, you know, we'll all draw cards instead of dealing cards. And I'm already trying to think of ways. It's like, how could I just take a normal deck of cards and do this? Because the only thing you really need to add are the four special cards and have the same back. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I just kind of like, well, why did it have to be that, you know?
And we talked about how you could probably create your own Tichu deck if you had two identical decks of normal playing cards,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and then you just marked up a couple, you know, so they have the same backs,
yeah.
but then you just marked up a couple saying, You could just write magic dog. Marker dog Phoenix, you know, and then do it that way.
I'm trying to think of a better way to do that.
Yeah, there's probably a snazzier way to do it. But yeah, it's really the theme thing is really kind of strange here. And really the rules for the Rio Grande version are really, I think, kind of bizarre. There's even this like this section here where it's talking about the 5-12 player idea. 5-12 players? Okay. And the box says 3-10. I'm so confused. Where it says things like, you know, the Mahjong begins, the uneven contest takes its course, and the winner becomes the great lord, and the tailender becomes the wretch. The players take their new won places, provided they that any positions have changed. The great lord is difficult to overthrow. There is no normal objective in the game. It is all for fun. At any rate, the great lord should be able to enjoy unrestrictedly all privileges and comforts of the house. A cup of tea, a little dance performance, a parasol, choice of TV channel, even the desire to continue this lordly game for another round. And then it says, like, how? And then it says, the above is an ethnological error by a rule writer, from which we editors distance ourselves. The editor responds, ignoramuses, error be blow. The Chinese greeting, ni hao, means person good, and is part of fundamental vocabulary of all Chinese games, except these dumb editors at Fata Morgana. The editors distance themselves from this distancing of their distancing. It's like, I don't even understand what they're saying.
It's like
here.
A Monty Python skit.
It's like a really bad Monty Python skit, so... but beyond that, I don't really have any deny points for the game. It's an inexpensive game. I think it retails for $14.95, but like I said, you could make your own deck of this if you really wanted to. And so it's a good game.
Teach you.
Okay, so that's Teach You. Good one, huh?
Yeah, I really liked it.
I think we'll pull this one out a lot. I think we can find some good occasions for this one to hit the table.
I intend to.
All right, so now we're going to shift gears and move into something completely different, and that is the wonderful world of Dungeon Lords.
It's time for the other Buy, Try, or Deny. We have a review of Dungeon Lords. It is a game where you are going to be taking on the other role. You're not going to be the heroes. You're going to be the bad guys. And John's going to tell you exactly how to be a bad guy.
So Dungeon Lords is designed by Vlada Shvatil, who we talked to last episode about Through the Ages, A Story of Civilization, also designed by Mr. Shvatil. And this is definitely a different style of game from that. It came out in 2009. Of note, it's actually one of the nominees for Game of the Year in the Dice Tower Gaming Awards.
Oh.
So you'll know by the end of this episode if we're going to vote for that one or not when we vote with the committee. So the idea in this game is that there are plenty of fantasy adventure games out there where you play a hardy adventurer who is going out as part of a party, adventuring party, to go into a dungeon and kill the monsters and take the treasure and go back to the tavern and, you know, revel in your
Huzzah.
Glory. Yeah. There's plenty of games like that and many games that we really enjoy, and, you know, role-playing games and board games alike. But there aren't too many games that focus on the idea of being the bad guy and what it takes to put together a really well-run dungeon. And so this game takes a very humorous look at, you know, what it takes to put together a dungeon, to hire your people, to keep your resources
to build it.
And then, you know, you do all this great work and then the adventuring party comes and just tears it all up, you know, how demoralizing. So this game is for, 2-4 players, although I would say, much like Teach You, this game is really designed mainly for 4 players, because if you play with less, there's a lot of rules changes and dummy hands and boards and stuff like that. So if you can play this game with 4, then you probably want to start off with a full complement of 4. Much like a lot of Vlada's other games, this game has a very extensive rule book.
Yeah.
It is very extensive, and it... And also, like a lot of, like Through the Ages, like Galaxy Trucker, like Space Alert, it's got, it sort of teaches you as you read it. And then there's all, it starts off with sort of a basic game and then progresses to a more advanced game. And so in this game, you start off actually with what they call a training dungeon. Because the idea is that you're building up this dungeon, you're putting rooms in place, you're hiring monsters, and then that's going to be taking place during sort of your production phases. And then at the end of all that, you're going to have a combat set, a series of combat rounds where the adventurers come in and try to, you know, wreck everything that you've tried to do. And so you really need to understand that combat part before you delve into building your dungeon. Otherwise, you don't really know what kind of things that you need. And so as a handy reference, they've taken all of the player boards that you get that are for your individual dungeon. They're fold in half. And when you fold them in half, it on one side is sort of a little training level. And it gives you an idea. It has some predetermined monsters and some predetermined traps and some predetermined adventurers. And you can kind of walk through the combat step to find out what things happen in what order and what kind of things you might need in order to be successful in staving off the adventurers. So I'd recommend that you do that if you get a chance to. We probably could have benefited from doing a little bit more of the training than we actually did.
It just seems like such overkill. And, you know, it's probably meant not to be, and we may have some people critique us on that, but it wants you to go through 4 training dungeons.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I personally can't stand the people that, when you're midway through a rules explanation, just be like, can we just play and learn it, you know?
Yeah.
I can't stand that, but on the other side of the coin, it's like 4 training dungeons seems just too much.
Right. I mean, for your first play, it's already going to take you 30 minutes to set everything up and explain the basic rules anyway. And then when you've got to add probably another 30 minutes for the training, this can be a real long affair to start the game out. Now, one thing that they do in the rule book, there's this sort of conversation going on between like the demon and the minion. And it's really funny. I mean, the rule book, you could just literally sit down and just read the rule book for fun and get a lot of good laughs and enjoyment. What it says here, for your first game, it says, you know, the rules for your first game are slightly simplified. Later in this book are rules for the full version of the game. And then the little demon says, yeah, I know what you're thinking. Hey, I'm a hardcore gamer. I can handle the full rules. Well, guess what? This game is designed for hardcore gamers, and we still want you to start with the simpler rules. You got to learn to irk before you can torment, kid. So that's clever and everything. But, you know, it sort of does illustrate that. You got to start with this sort of training and the basics and then move forward on that. So it requires, I think, a little bit of investment of time. And, you know, you got to really buy into this to want to get through the entire deal. So, So after you've done the training, I'm not going to go through the specifics of the training. When I get to combat, I'll talk lightly about that. I'll go ahead and back up and tell you ahead of time that this particular review, probably even more so than a lot of the Bytrod and I reviews that we do, is going to be very rules light. There's a lot going on in this game. And with Cody's permission, I'm actually going to go ahead and plug another podcast if you're okay with that.
Please.
The D6 Generation in their most recent episode, I think it's 57, you'll be able to find it online, does a very great, very extensive review of the rules to this game. So if you're looking for all the rules and everything you have to do, go check that out. Great podcast on the Pulp Gamer Network. We love those guys. And so I'm just going to go lightly over things and then tell you what we think of the game. But if you want that in-depth rules thing, go check out the D6G. Good?
Good.
Okay. So you're going to go through this sort of training step where you'll go through the different steps of your combat phase. And then you're going to kind of put those away. And you're going to unfold your board, which will lay out your player boards. What you kind of get with this game is you get individual boards for your dungeon that has spaces for all of your resources and all of your tokens and your cards and everything.
Really nice boards.
They're
great art.
You know. Artwork is just really, really top notch, I think. And then you have most of the board is about half of it is the area of your dungeon itself. It's a little grid of squares. Then you're also going to have like a main board, which is where you're going to be doing sort of your worker placement. This is kind of a worker placement game where you're sending out your minions to collect things or do things, and then they're coming back and bringing you these resources to your dungeon. So you got a board that has all of that captured on it. Very, very colorful. And you know, we'll describe the specifics of that in a second. Then you also have a board that is sort of a tracker for your production season. The game is going to go through like an entire year of what I would call production or building, and then you will go through a whole series of combat rounds. Then you'll finish that, then you'll go through a second year of building, and then go through the combat rounds, and then you'll score. So it's like build, fight, score. That's the whole game. And so they have a board that sort of tracks what the different steps that happen during your building year. That's pretty useful. Reminded me actually a lot of Kingsburg.
Mm-hmm.
So if you played Kingsburg, at the bottom of the board, they have that whole track that goes through all the different things that happen during the year. This is very similar to that because there's a lot of different little things that happen. on the reverse side of the tracking board for your building, you have a combat board where you're going to be laying out your combat cards that will trigger during the combat rounds, and also a place a little track around the end, around the board, that'll allow you to tally your final score at the end of the game. So, the point of this game is to win, and the way that you win is by getting the most victory points. Yes, I said victory points in a game that's themed with dungeon crawling. So
it gets worse.
And so the way that you're going to get these victory points is by various things. It's basically by having certain things in your dungeon. You're going to get points for rooms that you have in your dungeon, and for particular amounts of things that you're able to build. And then you're also, another interesting scoring thing is you have these things called titles that you get for having the most imps or having the biggest dungeon. And, you know, it's like kind of getting little certificates.
This was clever.
It's like being at the elementary school graduation where everybody gets, Johnny had he wore blue pants the most days, so he gets a certificate. So it's kind of like that. And so those are the main ways you're going to get the points in this game. So you're going to be starting out with a dungeon that has three of these little tunnels in them. So on the square, there are these little tokens that look like little crosses, actually, little X's, I guess. And that's going to represent tunnels that are being dug. Those can then be turned into rooms if you want to. And so you're going to be building that out. And then you're also going to be hiring monsters and getting resources and paying for them, all the while keeping in mind your reputation. There's actually a track on this game called the Evilometer. you start out at a certain level, and as you do certain things, you will either become more or less evil. And that's fine. Becoming more or less evil, it's kind of arbitrary, I guess. Except that if you get too evil and you get to a certain point in the Evilometer, then you will summon the wrath of the Paladin. The Paladin will say, "Hey, that dungeon is particularly evil. I must join the adventuring party and go and wreak havoc on it." And you don't want the Paladin, because the Paladin is a very, very strong adventurer. The adventurers in this game are represented by little cardboard tokens that have different abilities on them. You have your wizards and your thief and your fighter and your cleric and your Paladin. So you have all these different people that can join the adventuring party. You'll be selecting them during the course of the game, and the Paladin might join the party if your dungeon is evil enough. All right, so here is kind of how a game turn works with the building phase. So you're going to start off here. You have on your dungeon board three little minion tokens. There are three little cardboard dudes. No, they're not cardboard. They're wooden. Three little wooden dudes and they have a little spot on the board that looks like they're sitting in an office behind a desk. It's like the minion office. And you're going to be sending them out during the production phase to go and get stuff. And so then you also have these action cards that are going to be basically giving orders to the minions to go out and get these things. And then from there, you're going to build your dungeon. So the way that the production round works is you're going to start off in winter. And at the beginning of winter, you're going to take and you're going to have tiles for your rooms. You're going to turn over two of the room tiles, and they're going to go into like the bargain basement section of the main board. So there'll be two rooms available for purchase. You're also going to turn over three monsters. There's big piles of monsters tokens. Oh, I should also say that there's a separate board that comes with this that's called the Distant Lands board or something like that. It's basically the repository for all your stuff, all the stacks of tokens and everything. Yeah. So you're going to take three of those monsters and turn them over, and they're going to go into kind of the, what would you call it, Cody? It's like the monster lounge
it's kind of neat tavern. Because it's almost like a mirror image of, you imagine, in the RPG trope of, the adventurers go into the tavern and they find adventure. This you can kind of see, and the artwork is just great across the board. You can imagine, this dark dungeon lord, and you've got imps and trolls and goblins just all hanging out, and you're like, hey, goblins, come here,
Yeah.
It's kind of neat. And like a lot of the little things, the little minion offices that have the little paintings on the wall. there's some charming little things in there.
I mean, the idea of something like dungeon building being like this mundane office-y sort of task is pretty hilarious. So you're going to take those rooms and take your monsters, and those are the monsters that are going to be available for hiring for this round. Then also there's going to be some events that happen during the spring, summer, and fall. As well as your adventurers, you're going to start selecting adventurers in spring, summer, and fall. So in this winter phase, you're actually going to go ahead and put out your reveal your event tile for the spring and put all your adventurers out for the spring. So you kind of know what's coming up ahead of time. So then at that point, you're going to move the little progress marker, I guess, to the next step. And you know, that's the first part, just sort of setting everything out. So then what you're going to do is you're going to look at your hand of cards that you have. You have 8 action cards that do different things. And two of those, you're going to shuffle them up, and two of them you're going to place on your board into these slots that are called the inaccessible slots. So every round, you're going to have 2 actions that you can't do, and they're going to be inaccessible. And so you're going to turn those over, and then you'll have spots for 3 action cards underneath that. You're going to take the 6 that you have remaining in your hand, and you're going to choose 3 of them and place them face down on the board. Everybody's going to do this all at the same time. And these are going to be the actions that you're going to be taking during this particular season. So after you have done that, then you're going to, in turn, starting with the starting player, reveal these cards. And then you're going to send your minion out to do whatever the action was that have told it to do. And you go around in order, do your first action, everybody will reveal, you'll do your second action, and then you'll do your third action. And then from there, you'll be able to dole out the resources based upon how those minions were placed. This, again, feels a little bit like Kingsburg to me, or I guess a lot of other worker placement games like Stone Age and things like that. So the main board in this game has 8 areas on it where you're going to be collecting resources. And I think this is a really clever little mechanic as to how they've done it, is that if you think of a game like Stone Age, for example, that game has certain little slots where you can put guys. So if you send 3 guys out to a particular quarry or something, maybe there's like 3 more slots left. And then once those are full by another player, then no one else can go there. The same sort of idea is here, in that each different production area has 3 tiers, 3 different spaces where you can put minions. And so if you're the first person to get to a particular space, you're going to put your minion on the number 1 section. And then, you know, the next person who would want to go there would have to put it on the number 2 and the number 3 and so forth. So in a 4-player game, you might find yourself shut out of a particular location if everybody wanted to go there.
Or having to pay a higher price for something you really need.
Exactly, yeah. And so that's, and this is all spelled out really nicely on the board that, for example, we'll use the first one, food, as an example. Food is an important thing that you need to get because you need to use it to hire monsters and also to pay them and feed them later on. So if you happen to have put your minion on the first slot, then when we get to the point where you're going to take those guys back and claim your resource, you will pay 1 gold and you'll get 2 food for that. If you're the second one, you don't pay gold, but you actually will have to worsen your reputation. You actually will go up 1 on the evil marker, and for that you'll get 3 food. And then if you happen to be the third one, then you have to put your evil marker up 2 spaces, but you'll get 3 food and a gold. So it's sort of risk reward here. It's, you may
want the later slot sometimes, so it may be a timing issue there.
Yeah, the one interesting thing though is that you don't get to choose not to put your guy there. So let's say you really wanted to just pay the 1 coin and get 2 food or whatever, and because you're really evil to begin with, but you weren't the start player, so you end up being the third guy going there, and you get on the third slot. You can't turn your card over and say, I'll pass. Yeah. You got to put your guy there. So food, that's one. There's another. Then the other resources are as follows. You have reputation, where you're going to be able to make yourself less evil, and spread propaganda to make yourself look better. So there's different costs for those kind of things. You have an area where you can send your imps out to do digging of tunnels. So this game comes with a lot of little bits. Like, you have wooden tokens for the food and for the gold, and you've got little wooden tokens for your minions. But then your imps, which are going to be your workers that are going out and doing stuff, those guys are little plastic. Oh, what do they look like? They're like little imps, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're the little molded mini imps.
Yeah, they're cute.
Ton of them. Yeah, that's cute.
And so you're going to have a few of those to start off with, but you can send those imps out then to go and dig tunnels. And you have to dig tunnels before you can make rooms, and it's basically expanding your dungeon. So put your minion out there to be able to take 2 of your imps and go and have them dig. And, depending on where you are on that track, you might be able to send out more imps. So that's digging tunnels. Then once you're in a tunnel, you can actually send imps out to mine for gold. So that's another resource you can do, is to have imps go and will collect gold from you in tunnels. Then you'll also have sort of an imp resource where you can spend food or food and gold to get more imps. You can hire more imps to go into the, you know, put them in the imp the imp compound, the imp barracks.
Yeah, there's little bunk beds.
Yeah. And then you have traps. Now, when we get into combat, you'll see that traps are something that's important for kind of causing damage to your adventurers. And they're represented by cards, and you can spend money for those. So that's a resource you can get. Then the last two resources on this board are monsters and rooms. I mentioned that you're going to pull out two rooms and three monsters for every round. And so you're going to place your guys, your minions on the board to be able to hire monsters. This works in the opposite direction as the other resources. So when you start to get your resources, you're going to go number one, number two, number three in priority. But then with the monsters and the rooms, you're going to go backwards. So you actually start with the number three guy and then go to two and then to one. So that's a little bit different, and it basically means that for hiring guys, for example, the first person is going to have to pay a food in order to hire a monster, and then the next two guys aren't going to have to pay anything. You also, in addition to that, have to pay whatever is on the monster card as like his hiring cost or his salary or whatever.
Monsters aren't free.
They're not free. And then you can basically take and put that monster into your monster lair. So there's three monsters. So if you put three people on that track, then they're each going to get a monster. The room track is a little bit different because there's only two rooms available. So if you end up with three people on the room track, because it again goes in this reverse 3-2-1 order, the person who actually put their minion on there first would not get a room at all, because the number three and the number two person would have claimed it first. So, but you could be off the hook if only two people put their minions there, then, you know, you'd actually would get the room. So that allows you to purchase and obtain rooms for your dungeons. The rooms can't just be thrown on the board there. They actually have to be converted from tunnels. So you have to start off with tunnels and then you convert them to rooms. So that's the next step there, is that you play those action cards, you place all your minions out, and then you're going to go in the order that I just mentioned there, one at a time, and claim your resources and pull your minions back. So at this point, then, you're going to take your action cards, and the two that were inaccessible, you're going to pull those back into your hand, and you'll have access to them in the next round. The two cards that were right below the inaccessible ones are going to slide up, and those two now become inaccessible. And then the very first card of the three, you get to put that back into your hand. The only exception is that if you had a monster card, the action for buying monsters, if that was in the first slot, then to be able to pull that back in your hand, you actually have to pay one gold. Because monsters are really powerful and important, and so to be able to do that every single round, you got to pay a price for that. So that is, basically the main crux of the building is this resource management. And
it's like building the worker machine, placement. And then the next phase is pressing play.
Yeah. That's a very good way of looking at it, I think, is that, you know, you do everything that you can, and then you have a couple little decisions in the combat phase, but then it just kind of plays out.
It's somewhat similar to, you could even say, Space Alert in that regard, because it seems like the crux of the game is preparation.
Yeah.
And then you just try and hold on while the game plays itself.
Really, that's what Galaxy Trekker is, too. Huh? That's a game where you're basically building a spaceship and you're doing the best you can during that, and then you just kind of play it through you send it out into space, and then it gets beat up. So maybe this is kind of a Vlada Schwadl thing. This is kind of his... You know, I've said his name so many... I would hate it if I've really messed up his name. So my apologies if you happen to listen to this, sir, if I've messed
up. It's actually John Smith. That's
it's just spelled
it
differently, yeah. Anyway, you're going to continue on for four different phases. Now, one of the only differences here in the different phases, the different seasons, is that when you get to a specific spot in spring, summer, and fall, you're going to claim adventurers that are going to basically be kind of queuing up in the adventuring party at the door to your dungeon. And those are going to be handed out based upon how evil you are. And so the more evil dungeon lord is going to get the more difficult adventurer.
Yeah, to put it kind of an RPG spin on it, think of it, it's like if you have a higher rating on the evilometer, you know, you're the level 6 through 10 dungeon, and and if you're not so high on it, then maybe you have the introductory Keep on the Borderlands dungeon, you know.
Oh, that's a good way of looking at it, yeah. So it's pretty much like that. So now the only thing that where that kind of breaks down is that being evil doesn't necessarily mean you have a better dungeon. You know, yeah. You could have just done things that made you evil.
Kicked puppies.
Kicked a bunch of puppies. And so, you know, you want to keep an eye on that as far as your resources to, you know, so that you don't make yourself too evil. Because you don't want to attract that paladin. So once you've gotten through all four of the... Oh, well, one other thing to mention is that you have these events that happen in spring, summer, and fall. And there's one event is like a deck of cards, basically, where you draw a card and we'll do whatever that event says. So that's kind of a random thing. But then there's also paying taxes and paying your monsters. So if when it comes time to pay your monsters, you have to then take all your monsters and you have to pay the amount that you paid to hire them, you know, in food and gold or whatever, or in evil. Some of them just become more evil to hire them. You have to pay that again. If you aren't able to pay it, or you don't want to pay it, then you can basically fire them, and you kick the monsters out the door. But doing that makes you more evil, because they will go and spread bad stories about you amongst the other monster villagers. And so you can do that, and then there's also the an event called paying taxes, in which case you will need to pay a certain amount of gold for each room of your dungeon. If you're not able to pay that, it might be, I think it's maybe 2 per room. I think it's 2 gold per room. And I could be wrong there. But if you aren't able to pay that, then you have to, for every you know, tax that you're unable to pay, you get a mark in the dead letter office that's on your dungeon there.
The credit bureau.
The credit bureau. Exactly. And for every little token that you have in there, you're going to lose 3 victory points at the end. That's huge. Because mm-hmm. some of these games, when you get to the end of the game, you have like 2 victory points. Yeah. So you don't want to lose too much. So, you know, pay your taxes, good dungeon lords. Pay your taxes. And so once you get through all 4 seasons there, you're basically ready for combat. And you're going to line up your adventurers in a certain order on your dungeon board there. And then you're going to play out these rounds of combat. There's a whole deck of combat cards. And there's one deck for the first year and one deck for the second year. You're going to lay out 4 of those, and then you'll turn them over in succession to see. These combat cards basically represent a couple things. One is how much fatigue is going to be dealt to your heroes, to not your heroes, to the heroes at the end of each round. And then also what kind of magic spells might be triggered because during the round. And so, you know, basically each person is going to go, you're going to start off with a planning phase. The main things that you can select in your planning phase are what trap do you want to trigger? If you want a trap to trigger, what monsters do you want to fight with? I think that's basically it. Mm-hmm. You're going to just select those monsters. And on the monster cards and on the trap cards, it'll tell you what damage it deals. And sometimes it'll say that it deals a certain amount of damage to the first person, or it deals a certain amount of damage to each person in the party and things like that. Your monster cards are a little more complicated in that they have icons on them that say who they attack and then how much they attack for. One thing you got to kind of get your mind around in this game is that the monsters are attacking and the traps are attacking, and then they kind of the monsters go back to the monster tavern or whatever. They go back to your lair, the barracks. But the adventurers don't really attack you. The only real attacking that happens is maybe through those magic spells, but it's not like the fighter is going to deal damage to the monster usually, right. You know? And so, so it's a little bit different as far as the way the combat, the way you can't really think about it in an RPG sort of way. So the way the order of combat kind of goes is that you're going to, do your planning and pick your trap and pick your monsters. Now, the number of traps and monsters that you pick is going to be based upon where you are in the dungeon. Like if you're in a tunnel, you get a certain amount. If you're in a room, then you're going to get a certain amount that you can use. So you have to select those accordingly. It might be either 1 or 2 monsters, depending on which. Plus, there's also this whole class of monsters called ghosts, which are not really monsters. And you can usually have as many of those as you want to add it on. So more sometimes is better. So then after the first thing that's going to happen when they go into the room is that the trap is going to fire. And you'll turn over the trap and you'll deal damage accordingly. If you happen to kill an adventurer, because they have a certain number of wounds, and once you've killed one of the adventurers, it's going to go into your prison. And that's going to score you victory points. That's one of the ways you get victory points in this game is by claiming the adventurers. So then after the trap triggers, then there's going to be, you're going to look at that combat card and see if you have any fast magic spells. If you have like quick magic, then that's going to fire immediately after the traps. And that's going to be based, whether that happens or not, is based upon how many magic points the party has. So if the party has, and that's, it's all done by icons. It's very easy to follow icons on this. If there's enough magic points, then that quick magic is going to go off, and that's going to do something bad for you. Might cause your monsters to deactivate, or might cause, might disarm a trap or something like that. So, or might make you more evil. You know, it's various different things that might happen. After the quick magic, which may or may not happen, then your monsters are going to attack. And so then you will deal damage from those monsters to the adventurers and accordingly. And then after the monsters is what's called slow magic. If instead your combat card had a slow magic icon on it, then this is the time when that spell would trigger. Again, could probably do bad things for you. At that point, then you're going to have healing. If you happen to have a cleric in the adventuring party, then it will heal a certain amount of damage to each of the adventurers. And then you're going to deal what's called fatigue. At the bottom of that combat card is a certain number of fatigue markers, and the adventuring party will lose that number of, will gain that much damage based upon fatigue. So it's possible that they get through all the combat stuff and they're fine, and then they just die from exhaustion. You know, yeah. The fatigue gets to them. And so, you know, you'll collect guys in your prison if that's the case. And then if there's at least one adventurer left, then that room that they're in is going to be conquered and turned over. I don't think I mentioned at the beginning that adventurer is always going to start off at the room that's right next to the door to the dungeon, and then eventually they'll move down. So if there's still at least one adventurer left, then they're going to turn over that tile and it's going to be conquered. That's going to be negative two victory points for you, but it happens. And at that point, then you're going to move your party token, I guess, to an adjacent room. And then you'll go through the second round of combat. So everybody's going to be doing this, but there'll be four rounds of combat. And, you know, once you've used your monsters, then they can't be used for another round. And once you've used your traps, then they're pretty much gone. And you just try to get through these four rounds of combat with what you have. And then you set it up and do a second year of it. So everything's a little bit more complicated, a little more beefy in the second year. And that's pretty much it. I mean, you know, you go
through the flyby of Dungeon Lord.
You go through those same production steps and worker placement steps, and then through the same set of combats. And then at the end, you'll score. Like I said, there's lots of scoring conditions based upon the number of rooms that you have and these titles that you might get. And the thing with the titles is that, for example, let's say there's a title for the most tunnels dug. And if you outright have the most tunnels dug, then you get 3 points. If you share that title with someone else and there's a tie, then each of you get 2 points. And that's how those are kind of doled out. So that is the whole of Dungeon Lords.
Where it's dark as the dungeon, damp as the dew, danger is double, pleasures are few. Where the rain never falls, the sun never shines, it's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
So, Cody, why don't we start off, before we do buy, try, deny points, give me just your overall impressions of the game. Can you do that?
Yeah. Yeah, I can.
Could you do that for me?
It was interesting because from what I heard of just the quick blurb about the theme, I was really pretty excited about it. And I thought it was going to be a much different game. Because not to beat on the Euro hating drum or anything, but it's a Euro game with kind of this Ameritrash theme on it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you opened Descent and it turned out to be kind of this weird worker placement game. You'd be, you know, like, because the art, you know, is really iconic and it shows you one thing, and then you get in and you're just moving cubes around. It was just a little off putting to me. It's like, I don't mind playing a Euro occasionally if I know it's a Euro.
Yeah.
Don't hoodwink me like this. That's kind of the whole thing.
Got bamboozled.
Yeah, I'm like, what kind of game is this? So that was my pretty much impression through most of the game, was just confusion and trying to shoehorn it in somewhere.
Having said that, give me your buy points for this game.
Okay. The theme is fantastic. It's like John said, the way the rules are written and the way everything comes across, the artwork and And just kind of like the storyline, you know, at the end of the game when you score, you see if you got enough points to get your Dungeon Lord license, you know. I think that is great. It's funny. It could be used in an RPG. It's just really, really funny stuff. And the theme is top-notch.
Yeah, I actually have written down the same things, really. It's a fantastic theme, really well done, and the artwork is really, really well done. You really feel immersed in that. The rulebook is a hoot to read, and there seems to be reasons behind everything that they've done mechanically in the game. They've got some kind of funny, you know, text that goes along with that. So definitely some positives there. And I actually think, maybe a little contrary to what you're saying, I feel like it's actually a pretty good crossover between Euro mechanics with that non-Euro theme. I think that can be confounding and confusing depending on what kind of gamer you are. But if, you know, if you're someone who loves Ameritrash style games, but, you know, you want to dip your toe into the Euro mechanics, you know, this would at least give you that rich theme experience with those Euro mechanics tacked on. Now, it's kind of a pseudo buy point because I'm not sure if I'm completely 100% sold on it, but I can see that was probably the aim when the game was designed, was to create this very, very themey game that has those underlying Euro mechanics. So, what about try points?
The two that come to mind, the first I kind of mentioned in my overview, you really need to know the kind of game you're getting. On the shelf and bringing it to the table, if you knew nothing else about it, I think you would be confused. You know, I think you would say, oh, Dungeon Lords, oh, you're building a dungeon, oh, that's cool. And then you come in, you're like, oh, it's this, you know. It's just, I think, you know, if you do your homework on it, I think you can really discern whether this is for you or not. And my other kind of try point would be that it's hard just to bring to the table, learn the rules, and play it. It's kind of, there's this whole step of, you know, okay, there's these, there's a full training, four training dungeons, then you're playing a basic game, then you're playing the full game, you know. If you really do it by the book, how they want you to do it, this could be like a 4 or 5 hour affair, just learning it, going through all the training. And so if you know that ahead of time and you have people willing to do it, not so much a problem. We weren't really aware of that when we played it. We're like, oh, they want us to do this and then this and then this and this. And then you're playing, well, you're not really playing the full game. You're playing the basic game. And then, but if you get through all that, then we'll let you play the full game.
Yep.
It's just pretty taxing.
That is my number one try point is, and it kind of keys off of the rule book here, is that the rule book, while being very entertaining and themey and fun, it's long and time consuming, I think, to read through. And, you know, the designer's sort of stepwise approach to rules teaching may not be for you, you know, because I really feel like it requires a lot of buy-in. You know, like you're saying, if it's going to be a 3 or 4 hour affair, of starting with the simple and then going to the more complicated, you know, it's you, for one thing, I don't find that I'm playing with the same people all the time. Sometimes I am, but if I'm adding new people in, you know, let's say we played a 3-player game of this, right, with Kalen, and we played it and we played through like the basic game, you know. But then if we brought someone else in, well, then we got to take them through all the training dungeons so that they understand it. So this stepwise approach, you know, you got to really love it. You got to really love the game to be able to really buy into it. So a game like Through the Ages, which we talked about, which we really love, you know, I could see myself starting with a simple game and then wanting to sit down again and play the advanced game and then playing again and playing the full game.
But not all in one sitting.
No, not all in one sitting. But I feel like anytime you add a new person to the mix of any one of these games that the Svadil designs, you're having to, you know, go through this process, you know, and sometimes it's just a lot more fun to be able to sit down. And even if you got to spit out a 30, 35, 45 minute rules, you know, like Rune Wars, Rune Wars, I got to sit and talk for like 45 minutes while I'm explaining everything. But once that's done, you know,
you've got everything,
not 45
you
minutes, but you know, like half an hour, but then you've got everything you need and you can just play.
You don't have to play a bit. Yeah. You're exactly right.
You don't have to feel like you're on training wheels just about every time that you play.
I would rather have, you know, the wall of text thrown at me. This is how you do it. Okay, fine. In some settings, the step-by-step approach is good. It just gets tiresome.
Yeah. So that might not be for you. And I would say that, for being as themey as it is, player interaction is pretty minimal in this game. You don't, and it's a genre that I think screams player interaction, dungeon crawl, you know.
No.
And yet, you know, since you're in your own little dungeon world there with your own adventurers, the only interaction that you really have is competing for those spaces on the worker placement board. That's pretty much it. And if this were just a Euro game, I would say that's fine. That's enough player interaction for a pure worker placement game. But this has so much more involved in it that it just seemed, I just felt like there wasn't a whole lot, you know, there was a lot of fluff for not really that much substance.
Of lotta fluff.
Yeah. Wow. All right, so deny points. I know you can tell by now, listeners, that we were not real impressed with this one. So.
No, my two major deny points. The first one is that the game just feels like it happens to you. You know, you have that. I would say it's even less than Galaxy Trek or Space Alert, where you know you're preparing and then you know things happen. I thought I was just going through a spreadsheet at times. You know, it's like this happens and this happens, this happens. Yay, you know. It just seemed like there weren't that many points of decision or points of conflict that needed my input enough for the length and the depth of the game.
Yeah.
You know, it just feels like I was just called on a few times to make some decisions and the game will take care of the rest.
Yeah, boy, mm-hmm. That's a really good way of putting it. I really felt the same way. Mm-hmm. So you had a second one?
Yeah. this one I almost get kind of mad about because it seems like they had such a good theme and they wasted it with these mechanics. The theme is... I would like to see someone else take this exact theme and do a completely different mechanical game based off of it. Yeah. Because the theme is that good and to me the game is that bad that the marriage of the two just kind of make me mad.
See, I almost feel like... if they could have just put a little bit more Ameritrashy into it, like have dice rolling to resolve combat, you know, just something that, you know, I know that kind of flies in the face of maybe what this game was designed to be, but I do feel like you just sort of set it up. You're basically making, you know, three decisions each season. So 12 decisions each year, mm-hmm. you know, with those minions. And that's kind of it, you know, and then you get to pick what monster and what trap you pick, but then that's it. Then it does kind of run on autopilot and
anticlimactic at the end.
That's what I thought. You know, cause then it's like you're going through this checklist. Oh, how many of these you got? You know, then it's like,
it reminds me of Agricola at the end where you're just comparing things. You know?
It kind of does, you know, and again, I like Agricola and I like those kind of games. It's just that I don't want to, if I want that kind of game, I'll play Agricola or I'll play something with a Euro-y sort of feel with a game with this much theme. And I'll reiterate what you said. I think it's one of the best themes that you know, and the way the theme is integrated in the game is one of the best. That's a really high point on the game. But then don't put those kind of mechanics in the game. You know, I would much rather have it feel more like a Descent or like, you know, something like that. So
yeah, to echo what John said, it's like we're not advocating that all Euros should add dice to make them more exciting.
No, I wasn't saying that.
But we're just saying, if you're going to make a Euro game, make a Euro game. If you're going to make an Ameritrash game, make an Ameritrash game. Don't unnecessarily try and merge the two.
Yeah.
You know?
Because, I mean, we talked about Kingsburg, you know, mm-hmm. being something that had some, it's Euro, but it had sort of that fantasy theme. Real light, though. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a real light theme, I thought, you know, and I just didn't feel like it was as involved and themey. So I can sit down to that game, and it feels Euro. I mean, I feel like I'm playing a Euro game with dice, and that's mm-hmm. fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, and but if it was any more themey, then I would say, you know, dial down those Euro mechanics. So anyway, so that's kind of what we thought of Dungeon Lords. So you know, I mentioned the D6 Generation. If you go to their podcast for the big detailed review, they had a very, very different opinion of the game. Yeah. So spoiler there, but but anyway, so you know, it takes all kinds, and this game has gotten a lot of great accolades and also a lot of criticism on BoardGameGeek. So it's a little bit polarizing there.
In the old system, it would be a thorough deny.
Exactly, but that's kind of what we thought of Dungeon Lord. So about ready to close out this very strange show.
I say we do it.
All right.
Well, we thank you for listening to another what we think is a great episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Isn't that really all that matters?
That's right.
Okay.
We've got an interesting episode coming up. It's going to be a little delayed.
That's right. We're going to delay probably a week, maybe less, but probably a week because we've got Origins going on.
You're all going to be at Origins anyway.
So. Yeah, exactly. But I'll be giving you my post-Origins report. Might have some interviews and some recording that I did there at the convention. And we're going to be, as far as we know, the tentative plan is we're going to be reviewing the game World Without End, which is the sequel to The Pillars of the Earth. So also based upon a Ken Follett novel, it's Euro.
That's right.
Know, it's Euro, but you know.
But I know it's a Euro going in.
That's right. I've already kind of primed Cody there, so he's ready for it. So, but we invite you to check out all of the great ways that you have to contact us, which Wayne's going to be telling you about in a minute here. But I hope you enjoyed this episode, and until next time.
Go USA and game on.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.